Welcome to Asset Finance Connect's series of podcasts on the European asset finance industry. I'm Richard O'Donoghue, and for the past few months, I've been chatting to industry experts about the challenges and opportunities facing our industry in 2025 and beyond. As we move into the final few months of the year, we're going to keep those conversations going and continue to explore topics such as AI, partnership, sustainability, and captives. Thanks to our sponsors, Alpha, for their continued support, and we'll tell you a bit more about Alpha later in the podcast. So today, I'm delighted to be joined by Bjorn Vandenberg. Bjorn's been in our industry for close to 30 years, and currently he is the Director of Financial Services at Sanfi. Bjorn is also the chair of the Captives Forum in his spare time, which is an industry association working with captive finance companies. So Bjorn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Richard, for inviting me. We've spoken before, but not yet on a podcast, so it will be good experience.
We have spoken many times, Bjorn, at Captive Forums, and I know we're going to touch on the wider captive industry today and talk about what you're hearing from the members of the Captives Forum. But maybe let's start with Sanvic, where you work. And I think Sanvic is a name that a lot of people will not be familiar with in our industry. So maybe tell us a little bit about Sanvic.
Yeah. Well, no, I can. Sanvic is a Swedish company. It's a global high-tech engineering group providing solutions that enhance the productivity and profitability for manufacturing, mining, and infrastructure industry. During 2024, we had approximately 41,000 employees and sales in over 150 countries. The revenues were in the range of 11 billion euros. And then as a captive within Sanvic, we mainly focus on the mining and the infrastructure industry, mining being around 80% of what we do.
Okay, so with 11 billion euros, you're the biggest company that many people may not have heard of, possibly because you're in a very specialized industry. And I guess my perception of mining is probably 100 years out of date, which is men, and it would have been men, working in very cramped conditions, lots of dust, lying on the flats of their backs, chipping away at things. I'm assuming that is not the way the modern mining industry exists today. So what's a mine like today?
It's actually funny that you mentioned it, because before I joined Sanvic, I had sort of the same impression. I thought mining was guys in hard hats climbing down a ladder with a pick. It's nothing like that anymore. Modern mining, the primary focus in modern mining is environmental and individual safety. And what you'll see is that modern mining is mechanized. I mean, we still see lots of images of manual mining, but that's not the type of customer that Sanvic serves. So we see that transportation, drilling, it's all mechanized. And we see that also in sort of the trends nowadays in mining. It's electrification, especially when you're starting a new mine. Not having diesel fumes below ground is obviously good for your CO2 emission, but also for ventilation. It's a huge cost saving for ventilation. We see autonomous, remote. We see more and more of these mechanized machines being operated remote, which means less people underground, which means a better safety for those people. And automation. I think that's what we see in every industry, that more and more processes get automated because basically, it's in a more efficient way to drive your operations.
And is AI going to play a role in mining?
Yes, certainly. We also have a team working on AI solutions. As many corporates today, we're still finding out the best way to apply. But most certainly, we expect to see advantages coming there soon.
Okay. And talk then about the financing business, the business you're part of. You're a captive finance company. How do you support Sanvic, or what sort of customer base do you have? Maybe tell us a little bit about the general business.
Yeah, as a captive, primary focus is to help the parents sell more. And in parallel, obviously, we need to manage the risk and the reward of the portfolio. I mean, we work in an industry where we have many customers that without Sanvic Financial Services stepping in, they would not be able to secure the credit that they would need to buy the machines. So what we tend to do is not to compete with banks in our main markets, but to focus on the customers that really benefit from the additional expertise and risk appetite that we have to serve them with the right type of credit.
And are you taking this on balance sheet? Are you syndicating it down? How does that work?
Yeah, no. We predominantly work on balance sheets, but there are a couple of geographies where we work with partners as well, Southeast Asia, Brazil, India. And there we predominantly work with handpicked local partners. we've learned that they generally have a slightly better understanding of the market than maybe some of the international multi-country players, and that they, especially in mining countries, that they have a better understanding of what mining is all about, and therefore a better risk appetite that fits well with what we try to bring to our customers.
I know we talked about this actually in Amsterdam at the Captives Forum, where we had other, I would say, IT captive companies that tended to work a lot of the time with the big global players. Whereas your business it's got, I suppose, more, I don't want to call them emerging economies, but they're economies that the global banks maybe are less familiar with. Is that what sort of drives you to work with local partners?
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of the mines are nowadays positioned in more remote areas where maybe the financial service industry has not been as well developed. Maybe some of the more international players would actually shy away from these geographies. And even if they would have subsidiaries in those countries, then if the local team would propose a deal above a certain size, it would need to go up the chain. And by the time it hits sort of the International Risks Committee, a lot has been lost, and the appetite is usually less because the understanding of the market industry is sometimes not there.
Is it generally equipment you're financing, or is there a big services element in this business? Is there a software element?
Sandvik is a full service provider to the mining industry. We predominantly focus on equipment where we're asset-based. But we do occasionally finance software solutions and other type of services as well.
Again, maybe just kind of going back to the partnerships you have with local funders in particular. What do you look for in a partner? And again, this was a popular topic at the meeting in Amsterdam. I think a lot of people wanted to know, you know, what do captives look for when they're signing up a financing partner?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that became clear during the Amsterdam discussion as well is that there are some differences. We as an equipment financer to the mining industry, others, computers and the likes. But I think there's one consistency as well. If we work with partners, we expect the partner to have the same drive and the same attitudes as a captive has. And that means that they need to be responsive. They need to have the right level of risk appetite. Our parent expects us that if quarter end or month end is coming up and there is a large deal waiting and they want to get it pushed across the line, that we as a captive, that we deliver. But if we work with partners, that expectation is exactly the same. So it's crucial for us that partners have that type of setup and that type of attitude. Otherwise, it's going to be a difficult partnership.
So I guess a lot of it comes down to people.
In the end, a lot of it comes down to people. Yes, correct. They need to have the right attitudes, and they need to have an understanding of what our requirements are as a captive and a parent.
Do you find then, as you kind of find local partners, funding partners, that you have to educate them initially, or are you finding people that are very familiar with this industry, or is it a balance?
We see in some of the countries where we work with partners that there is a solid understanding of the mining industry. So if that is the case, then we just need to educate them about our type of equipment, what the right type of depreciation periods are, what potential residual values could be, etc. So that type of education still needs to take place. Where we work with partners who have not been as much exposed to the mining industry, It's a much longer process. It requires much more explanation. It's really a knowledge transfer at a different level.
And just you touched on it there about kind of residual values, etc. Can you talk a little bit about, maybe is there a second-hand market? Is there remarketing capabilities? Is there a short-term rental market?
All of it is yes.
I can move into the mining industry. I clearly understand it already.
You must have spent some time there. There's certainly, we sell premium equipment to the top 300 miners in the world. There is a group of second tier miners who would definitely like to use Sandvik gear. So there is a good residual value market for it. Plus, we build high quality equipment that after a refurbishment can certainly have a second life. In maybe a slightly different environment. Also short-term rental. We see short-term rental for different reasons. We see that mines have projects like short-term expansion projects, or they want to, certainly now with the commodity prices being elevated, that they temporarily want to ramp up production. So therefore, they want to bring in additional equipment. So we definitely short-term rental as well. A different reason for short-term rental can also be when the equipment is being maintained, especially when it's a longer term overhaul, for instance, of the equipment, then you need replacement equipment to keep production going. And most of the mines have 24/7 production. So if one piece of equipment is taken out for maintenance, then ideally they want to replace it immediately with something different.
So here's a personal question. Have you been down a mine?
Yes, I have been. I've been in several mines, and it's an interesting experience. Once you've been in different ones, you can also clearly recognize the difference in how things are organized on the ground. I mean, there are even mines right now where there's hardly any staff left, where all of it is automated, anonymous, or remotely controlled above ground. And that's definitely a very interesting experience.
Yeah, a scary experience.
Well, there are two types of mines. There are shaft mines, where you would go down a shaft in a very narrow container almost.
Like that.
That's a special experience. But there are also mines which operate to a ramp, and there you basically drive down in the mine. And then it's actually a special experience to see how long the drive can sometimes be. It can be multiple kilometers before you actually hit the area where the equipment is operating. Obviously, you have to prepare. You have to wear all your safety equipment. You have to be trained on what the procedures are. It's a special experience. You easily spend a day going in and out of the mine.
Wow. It sounds very different. Maybe not quite a Disneyland experience, but nonetheless something that maybe people should experience once in their lifetime.
It's a little bit less smooth than Disneyland, I would say. And less people queuing up as well.
I like that. So maybe we'll move back to the leasing industry more broadly and the captive industry more broadly. So you're the chair of the Captives Forum. So
yes.
let's ask the obvious question for people who, again, may not be familiar with the Captives Forum. What is it?
The Captives Forum is a dedicated non-profit trade association focused on supporting and advancing sales finance activities for the OEMs in Europe. If you look at the members, it varies from Dell to John Deere and from Canon to Volvo Financial Services, that is then. So we have about 25 members from different industries, all true captives. So they're all linked to an OEM and predominantly focusing on financing the assets from that particular OEM. And we get together around four times a year, and we pick the topics which are relevant across all the captives. And that can vary from AI. A recurring topic is product as a service, regulatory aspects. Some of the captives are regulated, others are not, but there are lots of regulations which apply across the financial service industry. But it's a good platform for knowledge sharing. And what we've noticed over time is that obviously there's the General Leasing Association, but sometimes they are a little bit dominated by the large international players we discussed before. And as captives, we sometimes have different challenges. And the Captive Forum is an excellent platform for getting together and talking about these topics.
And as you say, it's a very diverse group of captives, from technology to mining to heavy goods, etc. What are the kind of consistent themes that they're talking about at the moment, or the consistent challenges that you hear about when you meet?
One of the consistent challenges is one that we discussed earlier, the expectations from the parent. And the expectations are not just responsiveness, it's also risk appetite. So you have to sometimes structure your transactions in a different way. Or with a bit of more in-depth understanding of the particular asset of the OEM. So that's definitely a recurring theme. I think one that we're all facing is that we have a good mixture of smaller and larger captives. Some of the smaller captives are not regulated. Some of the bigger ones are. So there's also a constant debate around the use of bank licenses, because they are certainly bringing benefits to the ones who have them, but there's also a cost associated to it. And some of the smaller ones can operate like ourselves very effectively without one. So that's definitely a recurring topic. And as in many industries right now, tariffs, what are the implications of tariffs on the captive? What are the expectations to us? Can we just absorb the additional percentage, whatever has been agreed in the credit line that we've set up for a customer? Or do we need to make some sort of special arrangement? So those are sort of common themes which are being discussed right now.
We might as well touch on it. So what are the captives generally saying about tariffs?
We see different opinions. Some of them are able to absorb them. Others are more concerned, especially if you're dealing with more high-risk customers than the additional percentage that gets added. It cannot always be absorbed within the credit line because sometimes that's stretched already to the max. But pushing it on to the customer to pay it up front is also not always an option because the customer might simply not have the cash flow to support it. So there are different opinions around it. And I don't think we've seen the final outcome yet.
I don't think we've seen the final outcome on the tariffs either. So it's
No.
Even this morning, we can see more announcements. So that maybe that lack of clarity around what the long-term position is going to be makes it very challenging as well.
Yeah, and what we also see within the OEMs that they have a production strategy. So certain type of assets are created, produced in a certain geography, and they are then exported all across the world. So that also creates challenges because that means that one asset class could be impacted completely different than another asset class. And that also makes it difficult to sometimes predict what the right approach is.
Yeah, I guess everything is integrated into supply chains, global supply chains today. And therefore, you know, it's not just a simple matter of we're just going to relocate production because your entire supply chain is based around, you know, decisions you've made over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Just want to touch on something you raised as well, which was bank licenses and the broader topic of the regulatory environment, which appears to be increasing the costs for captives to do business. What are you hearing again from the members of the Captives Forum around this? And are some of them reconsidering their business models as a result of this?
I think the most extreme type of reconsidering is that some OEMs have actually stopped their captive, which fortunately is not the case with the majority of the OEMs. I think the majority of the OEMs recognize the value that a captive can add in incremental sales. What we do see is that some of the captives are really reconsidering what the right business model is. There are captives who have multiple banking licenses, investigating whether or not that can maybe be reduced to one or to two or maybe to regional banking licenses. There are captives who are even considering, especially mid-sized captives with a bank license, they are considering predominantly handing it back because there are alternatives. And there are not too many of the smaller captives that are today considering going after a banking license. In the past, there were definitely captives that had on their agenda, but that has now more or less disappeared. I think what is a big discussion is the impact of regulations. That seems to be only increasing, and it starts to have an impact, especially for mid-sized captives to fulfill the obligations which go along with holding a license. It's becoming a lot.
And we've had a number of people actually over the past couple of months talking about the relevance of captives in an environment where, as you point out, costs are increasing, and particularly the regulatory costs. Do the members of the Captives Forum still feel that a captive is the right model and they still feel relevant to their parent companies?
Yeah, what we see is we have a large group of captives who have a significantly high penetration when it comes to the number of assets that they finance. So I think captives can stay relevant to their parent as long as they stay close to their parents' objectives and challenges. And in parallel, captives need to be doing what they do best, and that is providing credit solutions to customers who would maybe otherwise not be able to obtain the credit to buy the product that the OEM produces. And then they can do that because they have this unique understanding of what the asset actually is and how the market operates. They've been operating in those markets for a number of years, so they have built up significant expertise to do that. It's not easy for a general finance company to step into that void that would be created if a captive would ever cease to exist.
Alpha has plenty of experience helping captives navigate rising regulatory costs and complex partnerships in difficult markets. Some of Europe's major names use core Alpha Systems functionality to address these challenges, with usage-based contracts now a mature reality for a number of providers. If your systems are ancient, and if you're providing the value that only a captive can, Alpha Systems is the gold standard, supporting joint ventures and white label solutions, as well as banking as a service models. So go talk to Alpha or find out more at alphasystems.com. That's ALFASystems.com. And I think, you know, again, it's a topic that we've talked about a little bit, is the current environment, because of increased costs and a bigger focus in many of the OEMs on costs generally, it probably does create more opportunities for partnerships. Again, are you seeing that within the members of the Captives Forum, that they're maybe signing up to partners where in the past they would have tried to do everything themselves?
Yes, I think it's a constant evaluation within every captive. What do we hold on book and what do we potentially offload? And that can be at the start of the deal. Do we need to involve more partners to potentially just generate leads and hand over deals at the start? Or do we offload part of our book that has already been generated? I think it's a constant discussion in every captive, because it's not just cost of regulation. It's also cost of interest. It's cost of capital. It's the combination of it all.
Well, look, I my personal view, as you probably know, is I think there's a great opportunity for funders to partner with captives. But I think you touched on a number of the topics earlier, which was they've got to understand the timelines that captives operate under and the pressure that captives operate under and be able to adjust to that. And then I think for funders, they need to understand the value they bring versus the value a captive can bring, and kind of come together and work out how can they jointly put together the best proposition for both the OEM and the OEM's customers.
Yes. Yeah, and there's discussions around creating JVs for a particular type of product, including services. I mean, there's a raft of different solutions which are on the table. And in the end, I think you're right. The only way for partnership to work is if both parties are willing to constantly invest. And that requires a lot of effort.
So, last topic, and again, sort of going back to maybe a more personal topic, but trying to bring it into a business context. You mentioned that, you know, going into a mine was, you didn't use the word scary, but you said it was sort of a challenging experience. But you were kind of prepared for challenges because you've got a military background. And I'd love to understand, maybe if you can share, you know, a little bit about how you ended up in the military, you know, what you did, and has it helped as you kind of moved into the leasing industry?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I ended up in the military because as an 18-year-old, I wanted probably something different than just what everybody else did. I go to university, finish your studies, or maybe I was looking for a bit more adventure. So I decided to go to the military academy, the Dutch equivalent of Sandhurst, I think it's called in the UK. No, and you definitely learn a lot of things there which you might not learn in university, because military leadership is not about shouting really hard at a person who fails, right? That's not military leadership. I think there's quite a bit of misperception around what military leadership is. And as any leader, I think to be effective, you need to be able to do three different things. You need to be able to analyze, that's the as-is situation. That's fairly easy, right? Because this doesn't work. That's also analysis, right? But then you need to be able to articulate what does success look like. And therefore, you need experience, you need knowledge, maybe even a little bit of creativity. There are less people who can do that. But I think the most difficult part is moving from A to B, because that requires convincing individuals, challenging them, driving them forward, making them understand why you're actually going from A to B. And I think if there's one thing that you learn to do well in the military, is how to get people moving from A to B. And then again, shouting at people who failed, that's not the way to do it. It requires building up a lot of trust with the people you work with. If you're in a war zone or in a peacekeeping mission or even during a military training exercise, that element of trust is probably the most important one, because they are not going to do something which is extremely dangerous if they don't trust the person that asked them to do it. I think establishing that relationship with your employees and working with them in that way, I think is maybe one of the key takeaways from the military that's helped me a lot throughout my career. And then there are a couple of simple things like, right, delivering on commitment, being on time, having your shoes polished. No, that's probably not the best.
Well, I have noticed when I attend captives forums, you are always there on time. So you haven't lost that military discipline. But you mentioned building trust, and it's you know, probably the key thing in any team. How do you go about that? Or how do you go about it maybe in a military context? And again, is it transferable to the corporate environment?
Yeah, it is. Trust is something you build up over time. Trust is something that is not just in what you say, right? Because people will see through if what you say is not what you do. So in the end, people need to understand your intentions. And if your intentions are correct, then they will trust you. And then if you communicate it in one way or the other, it's probably less important than that they truly understand that you've got the best intentions, and certainly the best intentions with them, that it's not just about the corporate, that it's not just about you, but it's also about them. And if you can build that type of working relationship, then I think the trust element will follow. But it's you cannot expect people to trust you overnight, right? It takes time.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting message about that. If people understand your intentions are good, the communication becomes maybe less critical because people will kind of see beyond the communication. And I think that's encouraging as well, because a lot of people are very focused on how am I going to deliver this message? You know, how do I get the message across? And I'm not saying it's unimportant. But I think if people know you are coming from the right place, then they're maybe more forgiving if you don't deliver the message as well as you should.
And if they know that your intentions are good, they learn to differentiate between the situation which you're in, which might be bad. That also applies in corporate life. So the situation where you're in might be bad, but you are trying to do the best to get out of that situation, to make things better. And they also realize that I mean, nobody is Superman, right? You can't change everything overnight. But as long as they know that you're taking the right steps, doing the right thing. I mean, there are a couple of other things, which is related to military leadership, like resilience. You need to be agile, these type of things. But that's also part.
Yeah, but I think the fundamental thing you said is trust. And you know, I think that's absolutely applicable in the corporate world, and particularly today where there's so much change going on. Being able to explain to people or demonstrate that this is what you're trying to achieve, then people will follow you if they know that, you know, you're trying to achieve the right things.
So much change, but also so much noise, right? It's becoming more and more difficult to know who to trust.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been a very wide-ranging conversation from Sandvik and the mining industry, which, as you probably appreciated, I didn't know very much about, even though we've met numerous times. We enjoyed that part of it. And look, I think the captives piece, again, if there was a takeaway message, it's the opportunities to partner, but the need for funders in particular to understand what the captives are trying to achieve and then align with those. And I guess the military piece is, again, you know, very transferable, and the importance of, you know, communicating what your intentions are and demonstrating that those are genuine and building that level of trust. So Bjorn, I know we'll meet again, I'm sure, at a captives forum in due course. And I'd just like to thank you for your time this morning. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Richard, for inviting me. It was a real pleasure. I agree. So it was good. It was good to talk.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Asset Finance Connect, sponsored by Alpha. I've spent much of my career in captives, so it's always great to share experiences with people that have a similar background. It's even more interesting when they come from an industry about which I have very limited knowledge. And mining is definitely such an industry. Partnerships are of crucial importance to captives such as Sandvik, and Bjorn talked about the importance of partners having a similar drive and attitude as the captive, particularly when it comes to responsiveness. In my experience, this is critical, and the most successful funders are those that work according to the timelines of their captive partners rather than expecting the captive to adjust to the funder's timelines. If you've enjoyed this podcast, look out for more episodes in the coming months, and we always welcome suggestions on topics or guests for future podcasts. Thanks for listening.